Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have Richard Thaler, an economist and one of the true pioneers in the area called behavioral economics, which is really a hybrid between psychology and economics. He's going to be talking about his 2008 book, which has really been causing quite a stir in the field of economics. The book is called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Really, the crux of the book, which he's going to explain in detail, is that when you offer people just a ton of different choices, and the choices are difficult, and they're difficult decisions, sometimes people don't make the best decisions for themselves, and best meaning as judged by themselves. So please stick around. Thanks so much for listening.
Hello.
Professor Thaler.
Yes.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm ready for you.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, first of all, for the interview.
No problem.
Okay. All right, let's jump right into it. One of the ways in which Nudge is fascinating is that it clearly outlines many of the biases that enter into the decision-making processes of humans, causing people to sometimes not make the best choice. And best, as you guys outline, is best means best as judged by the people themselves. Or even,
right.
Could you talk about this a little bit?
Well, you know, we really are trying to contrast the way real people behave with the way economists have modeled the way people behave. So in the book, as you know, we distinguish between two kinds of creatures, humans and econs. And econs are the imaginary creatures that populate economics textbooks, and they're really, really smart, as smart as Larry Summers. And they're completely lacking in emotion and have no self-control problems. And most of us are not like that. So we get befuddled when we are confronted with an array of complicated mortgages, and we wake up on New Year's Day with a hangover. So the goal is to try and develop a way of thinking about all kinds of questions, but especially public policy questions, with these humans in mind rather than the imaginary econs that many public policies have been built around.
Just to kind of review some of the biases a little bit and the emotions that enter into people's decisions that sometimes people don't really realize, it's so interesting. Like one study you have is that how 94% of professors think that they're better than 50% of the other professors, which is really impossible. And then also the one where if somebody knows somebody that was in a flood, they're so much more likely to purchase flood insurance. So these are the types of biases that enter in. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Well, the two you've mentioned, the first one is roughly called overconfidence. So before I start teaching my class to MBA students, I do a little poll where I ask them to anonymously predict how they will do in the class. And 90% of them expect to be above the median, which, of course, is impossible. Only half can be above the median. And that pretty much applies to everybody. Everyone thinks they have an above-average sense of humor. They're above-average drivers. And, you know, as a result, we're driving on the road with a lot of people who think they're above average drivers, which is pretty dangerous. What was the other one you mentioned?
I talked about, I think, the availability, the flood
insurance. Oh, right. Right. So my psychologist friends, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, coined the term the availability heuristic for the idea that we tend to think of things as more likely if it's easier to recall instances of that sort. So we're now very much aware of the possibility that real estate prices can fall. And but until the last year, most people thought that hardly ever happened because they couldn't remember it happening. And the example you gave of the flood insurance is a great example. People buy flood insurance if they know somebody who was in a flood or if they were in a flood, rather than reflecting the real probabilities of having to face that problem themselves.
I also want to quickly focus on the status quo bias, because I think it is so strong and can really be applied so broadly, even outside of the scope of your book. Could you talk about this bias and how it affects our decision making?
Well, the status quo bias is really a fancy term for inertia. And when in doubt, we do nothing. And that sounds harmless enough, but it can be quite costly. So just to get the intuition of it, think about you're watching some TV show, you're sort of spacing out. The next thing you know, you're watching the same show, another show on the same channel, not because it's any good, but because it came on and you didn't bother to exercise your thumb enough to click to another station. So again, that's fairly harmless, but we know that many people don't get around to doing all kinds of things, including joining the company 401k plan. And so we advocate trying to think very hard about what the default options should be, and then making sure that those default options are chosen to be the ones that people would select for themselves if they gave it really due consideration and had all the relevant information.
I just want to remind everybody that you're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Richard Thaler, a behavioral economist, about his recent book, Nudge. We just kind of reviewed a lot of the biases that enter into humans' decision-making processes, and now we're going to be talking about the effects of those biases and some of the suggestions that he has. So please stick around. Thanks so much. One thing that your book really gives us insight into is when people are out in the world deciding, for example, I know you mentioned which cell phone carrier to choose or insurance plan or credit card or which mortgage to get. Not only do these biases that we briefly brushed over enter into our decision-making, you talk about how sometimes companies can take advantage of these biases and how many times it's difficult for consumers to make better decisions or good decisions when these decisions have delayed effects and we really don't get feedback on whether we're making a good decision for us.
A good example of that is choosing a cell phone plan. It used to be picking, in our parents' generation, there was one kind of phone. It was black, and that was it. And with cell phones came very complicated set of prices. It sort of reminds you of airlines, only it's even worse. And so it's hard enough to figure out what the best plan is, and then you don't really get good feedback on whether you made a mistake. And what we advocate in the book is that sellers would be required to provide you with information in an electronic form. So that two kinds of information. One is how much they charge for things, and the other is how much you use the product, whatever it is, your cell phone, how many text messages you send, how many emails you send. And that usage information really ought to be your property. And the seller ought to provide it to you. And if you have that information, you could make much better choices. And what we think is that websites would emerge that would help you do that. Now, there are some websites now that do that. Actually, for credit cards and cell phones, there's one that's called BillShrink.com, as in shrink your bill, BillShrink.com. And it's pretty good, but you have to give them the data. They don't have access to all the providers, and they don't have access to your usage information unless you give it to them or allow them to get inside your account. And so we think that if the government forced providers to share that information with us, we would be able to make much better choices.
One of the main themes of the book, which spurns a lot of this discussion, is that just like all buildings in cities have a specific design, so do all choices that we make and all decisions that we enter into. And that it's really unavoidable that decisions that we make are designed in certain ways. Can you talk about how that motivates your book?
Well, in the book, we coined the term choice architect. And the idea is that, you know, say when you go into a restaurant, the chef decides what he's going to cook, but there's somebody in the restaurant, it could be the chef, it could be somebody else, whose job it is to make up the menu. And there are a lot of decisions that the menu designer has to make. What order to put the dishes, how to group them, should the cold appetizers be separated from the halal appetizers, is salad a special category, and so forth. Now, what the research in the psychology of decision-making shows is that all those seemingly irrelevant factors matter. And which order the dishes are presented will influence what you choose. So given that, and given the point you just made, which is an extremely important point, which is that there's no neutral way of presenting the information, then the choice architect has a decision to make about how to present it. Now, if I'm in running that restaurant, I might decide to feature the items that I make the most money on, or the items that I think the customers are going to be happiest with because I want them to come back, or the items that I've got a lot of and I'm going to have to throw away. There are many motivations one can use. And we stress that, you know, nudging can be for good or for bad. We're not naive about this. And we just urge choice architects to nudge for good when they can. And when I'm in a book signing, I always sign the book Nudge for Good.
One tool that you guys talk about in the book that could really help people help themselves make better decisions is this recap. Record, evaluate, and compare alternative prices. And or I've heard you also call it electronic disclosure. So it's really a tool to help people make better decisions by being able to see the facts out in front of them. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Well, you know, consider a mortgage. When you apply for a mortgage, the law says that they have to disclose all the information about how that mortgage works. But it comes in 20 pages of unintelligible gibberish that nobody ever reads. So what we're suggesting is, instead of that, or in addition to that, you get an electronic file that has all of that information in a machine-readable form. And again, websites would emerge that would translate in that information for you and help you become a more intelligent shopper. And we think if that had been available, then some of the people who took out mortgages they really couldn't afford, that is one of the reasons we're in the current financial crisis, some of those would have avoided that mistake.
And, you know, a lot of other very interesting suggestions that you guys have help people make better decisions have, and this applies in so many different areas, you know, that there could be how in Europe, many hotels, especially in Europe, you could turn off one switch and all the lights and not the clocks in the room go out, and how there's a thermostat that could have a little signal on there how much money you're spending by having the heat on high. These are some ideas that just a couple of the many that you suggest in your book that could help people make better decisions.
Right. I think there are really two principles in those examples that you're citing. One is that we just want to make things easy. So, you know, it's not that people like using energy. Sure, they might like to be cooler on a hot summer day, but all things considered, they would rather have a lower electricity bill than a higher one. And if you can make it easier for people to accomplish their goals, which would be to reduce their energy bill, there will. So if there was a switch that you could flip on your way out the door that would shut off all the lights but not turn off all the clocks, we'd be much more likely to do that than if we have to run around the house flipping all the switches. And since we wrote the book, I heard from a guy who has a gadget that will do that. And so I think that we will see more technology. And that's really the other point, that technology is our friend, and there are lots of ways that we can use technology to provide people the feedback that they need. So, as you say, when you turn the thermostat up a couple degrees on a hot day, you know you're kind of saving money, but you have no idea how much. And there's a nice experiment they ran in Southern California where they installed something called the ambient orb in people's homes. The ambient orb is just a light bulb that glows if you're using a lot of electricity. And the more electricity you're using, the brighter it glows. Well, putting that in people's homes reduced energy usage in peak periods by 40%. And you know, it's very low cost. Another example is if you tell people how much energy they're using compared to their neighbors. So people in similar homes to yours use less energy than you. Getting that kind of information can save as much as 6%. And that costs nothing to provide.
Another major point of your research is that the framing of the issue makes such an enormous difference.
Well, that's right. We know that, an ice cream that says that it's 90% fat-free is more attractive than one that says that it's 10% fat. And so the way you describe things can matter, and policymakers can use that as well. Think of cigarette warnings. We've had cigarette warnings for years, and over time they've gotten a little scarier and probably more effective. So, one thing policymakers do is communicate. And right now we have a president who's a great communicator, and he can probably use those communication skills, again, to help people make better choices.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with behavioral economist Richard Thaler about his very recent book, Nudge, really talking about how if people had better information displayed in easier ways to understand, they can make better decisions. So please stick around. Thanks so much. Can you talk a little bit about how your book really challenges some of the conventional economic schools of thought? For example, how there was an Environmental Protection Agency program where people had to just follow voluntary standards and how it works so well.
Well, you know, the example you're giving is that it turns out just asking people to announce how much energy they're using has a beneficial effect because big polluters might be a little ashamed or their neighbors will get on their case. And in the case of the environment, we, like most economists, think that the most effective thing that we can do is have a carbon tax or cap and trade. But I think that the main thrust of our book is that on top of that, there are all kinds of other things that we can do that will enhance getting the prices right and will make all of these efforts more effective.
What I was kind of trying to get at is that how this neoclassical school of thought in economics is really baffled by Wikipedia and how people don't do things only in their self-interest, but they do feel more of a community sense. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Well, you know, in traditional economics, Wikipedia, neither Wikipedia nor National Public Radio exist because everyone would free ride and wait for somebody else to write the article up or donate the money. And fortunately, people are a little nicer than economists give them credit for. And that's fortunate because the world would be a hellish place if people were as unscrupulous as economists think they are. Now, it's not to say that there aren't unscrupulous people out there. There are, but there are also people who care about their neighbors, and if we give them a chance, they'll help out.
and kind of finally to wade into the political debate for a minute, you and Professor Sunstein talk about how the goal of the book is really to try and help to bridge the divide between the polarization of the Democrats, who are more about command and control and big government, and Republicans, who are more about laissez-faire and in favor of very small government. And you've even talked about how the ridiculously ambitious goal in your writing is that it might help create a new way in which people talk about politics. Can you talk about this new way, the third way that has been mentioned, and how it's going?
Well, you know, we think that, as you say, we had a ridiculously ambitious goal, was to create a set of tools that people on either side of the political divide might find attractive. And because we think that in the end, most of us are in favor of having a cleaner environment and so forth and so on. We agree on the goals, but there's this difference of opinion on the kinds of tools that we should use. So by devising strategies where we nudge people rather than force them, we think that the people on the right can say, yes, people's freedoms are being kept, and people on the left are saying, well, yes, we're achieving the goals. And, you know, whether we're having any success on that, you know, it's too soon to say. But, of course, we do know that President Obama has hired my co-author to be, as they call him in the press, the regulation czar. He's the head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, or will be when he's confirmed by the Senate, assuming he's confirmed by the Senate. And there are a bunch of other behavioral economists working for the Obama administration. And at the same time, the ideas in the book have been picked up by the conservatives in the UK. David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party and the person most people think will be the next prime minister in the UK, has read the book and, to our great pleasure, assigned it as required reading last summer to all the Conservative members of Parliament. So at least there's some hints that at least one Democrat and at least one Conservative like the ideas. And so we're optimistic that maybe they'll catch on.
As I've heard you mention in a podcast recently, how there's not much difference between the Conservatives in the UK and the Democrats in the United States. I've heard Professor Sunstein on the Glenn and Helen show talk about how there's some resistance from some people about these ideas, about choice recap and trying to help people make better decisions. Could you talk about, and he talks about how the resistance sometimes stems from people misunderstanding your guys' ideas. Could you end on that?
Sure. So, you know, I think, first of all, I think the people who have had the most negative reactions to the book really haven't understood the book, and I sometimes think haven't read the book. So the reaction we most often get from the right is from people who think that that we don't really... the libertarian part of our proposals that we don't really mean, that somehow we're trying to pull a fast one, and that there's some slippery slope, and the first we're going to go for automatic enrollment, but then the next thing is we're going to have prohibition. And, you know, I don't think anybody who's read the book can really think that that's what we believe. It's certainly not what we say. Now, I think what Cass was referring to is we also get some criticism on the left, and that will be from people who think that nudges aren't enough. Now, the first thing I would say about that is nowhere in the book do we suggest that nudges are the only strategy that we should use. So, for example, we need to remember that fraud is against the law. Bernie Madoff didn't need to be nudged. We needed to have an SEC that was watching what he was doing and enforcing the law. So fraud's against the law, murder's against the law, drunk driving is against the law. Those are all places where we need shoves, not nudges. And so the people who don't think we're going far enough, that's what politics are all about. And you can argue that we should have more bans and mandates and fewer nudges. What we want to argue is that we can accomplish a lot without shoves. And why not start with that?
Professor Thaler, thanks so much for being a part of the Logic Consortium.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jake.
And that was our interview with Richard Thaler, behavioral economist, about his very recent book called Nudge. Thaler and his co-author Cass Sunstein have been causing quite a stir in the field of economics and in the political arena in the last 5 years. First with a few articles on what they call libertarian paternalism, and most recently their book Nudge. They're using libertarian in the context that they're really trying to help preserve freedom of choice, and paternalist in the sense that they're trying to make the decisions for the people easier by helping display information in more readily understandable format and make things easier for people to understand. Well, one example that they really use in the book that we didn't discuss in the interview is the example of school choice and school vouchers. While the right now is saying that all you have to do is just give people a choice and they'll choose the good schools and the bad schools will phase out, the people on the left are saying we got to make all the schools good. And that if we do have people, some people on the left are saying that if we do have school vouchers, then the information wouldn't get out to the people in a readily understandable way, and the people who don't have the good information will not go to the good schools. Here, people are trying to nudge people that they would get the good information and they would be able to readily understand it. That good information about schools would be widely disseminated, so we could allow people to make the right decision. So they're saying it's kind of a hybrid between the left and the right, and really trying to bridge some of the divide. Thanks so much for listening to the Logic Consortium. You can find our past shows at logicconsortium.blogspot.com, and to comment or suggest a show, or if you want to even try to help host the show, go to the Logic Consortium blog. And thanks so much to Matt Hudson and Scientific Map for this great music. They're playing in early May at the Tonic Room. You can find them at Scientific Map at their MySpace page. So everyone, thanks so much for listening.